1,500 Rohingya Muslim refugees were relocated to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal on Saturday. The move came despite opposition from human rights groups concerned about the site's vulnerability to storms and flooding. This brings to around 6,700 the number of Rohingya refugees that Bangladesh has moved to the island of Basanchar since December. Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but some of the first group of refugees who were relocated spoke of being coerced. The government also says overcrowding in refugee camps in the Cox's Bazar district fuels crime. The Rohingya are a minority group who fled violence in neighboring Buddhist-majority Myanmar. They are not allowed to move off their new island home, which is several hours' journey away from the southern port. Some refugees did tell journalists they moved to escape violence in the camps where they were previously housed and to have a better life. Hundreds of Tunisians marched in the capital on Saturday to protest against police abuses they say are endangering freedoms won in the 2011 revolution that swept away authoritarian rule. And hundreds of riot police confronted the demonstrators, leading to scuffles. There have been near daily protests since mid-January, the anniversary of Tunisia's revolution that sparked uprisings across the region in 2011, known as the Arab Spring. Tunisia was the only Arab state to emerge with a democratic system in place. Police have arrested more than 1,000 people during the demonstrations over the past 2 weeks. The protesters are upset about financial inequality, the marginalization of the poor, and what they say have been heavy-handed police tactics. This is VOA News. Russian businessman Arkady Rotenberg said Saturday that he owns a huge palace in southern Russia, which jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny had linked to President Vladimir Putin. Navalny and his anti-corruption foundation have published a video in which they allege the opulent mansion belonged to Putin. The video has been viewed more than 100 million times. Rotenberg is Putin's former judo sparring partner. He sold his stake in a gas pipeline construction firm in 2019 for a sum, which RCB Business Daily put at some 75 billion rubles or $990 million. Rotenberg said he bought the palace 2 years ago. His announcement came in a video published by MASH Channel in Telegram. Putin has denied ownership of the palace all along. Navalny was remanded in custody for 30 days on January 18th for parole violations he says were trumped up, and he could face years in jail. He was arrested after flying back to Moscow from Germany, where he had been recovering from a nerve agent poisoning last August. After Navalny's arrest, thousands of people joined unsanctioned protests across Russia last Saturday to demand the Kremlin release Navalny from jail. And here are a few more stories related to the global coronavirus pandemic. The Norwegian government will gradually loosen the capital region's coronavirus lockdown, allowing some shops and recreational activities to reopen from February 3rd onwards. That's what the health minister said on Saturday. The outbreak of a more contagious variant of COVID-19, first identified in Britain, had prompted the introduction of stricter measures on January 23rd, including the closure of all non-essential stores in and around Oslo for the first time in the pandemic. Taiwan's government on Saturday reported the island's first death from COVID-19 since May as it battles a small and unusual outbreak of locally transmitted cases. A woman in her 80s with underlying health conditions died after being infected with the coronavirus as part of a domestic cluster connected to a hospital. That's according to the island's health minister. And India reported its lowest active number of novel coronavirus cases in 7 months on Saturday. It's a year after the virus was first confirmed in the country. A year ago, a student from the southern state of Kerala tested positive for COVID-19 after returning to India from Wuhan in China, the global epicenter of the virus. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Lawmakers trigger the Trump impeachment trial, but there are increasing signs Democrats won't have enough Republican support to convict the former president. Also, Biden signs a flurry of executive orders. What does it tell us about the new president's agenda, and what can we expect from Biden's relationship with Congress? Plus, the Biden administration promising to boost vaccine supply, but getting enough shots into people's arms still proving to be a challenge. Molly, Linda, a real treat to have you both on this week, especially as we try and sort out some political gamesmanship on Capitol Hill. I know you both will help us get through the impeachment forecast and some other pressing topics. Let's dive right into impeachment. This week, Democrats triggered the start of the impeachment trial of, well, now former President Trump. It's his second impeachment trial, I might add. It's a very unique club. He's the only president to be facing two impeachment trials. There's one article of impeachment here charging Trump with incitement to insurrection over his role in the January 6th storming of the Capitol. Linda, give us the bullet points here. We'll get to the politics in a moment, but when is the trial likely to start? How long can we expect it to last? And do we have a sense of what Trump's defense might be?
The trial is due to start on February 9th, and given a vote that took place this week, that it was a measure from a Republican Senator Rand Paul trying to dismiss the trial, and that was defeated, but with only 5 Republican votes. So that is a very strong indication that Donald Trump will not be convicted when the trial does take place. And so the Democrats essentially just want to get this over with as quickly as possible. It might last a week. The timing is such that it obviously coincides with the beginning of President Biden's term. He faces massive crises on numerous fronts, and they don't want this to swamp Biden's agenda. As for Trump's defense, the first and foremost defense is that this is what they're doing is unconstitutional, that you can't have an impeachment trial of a president who's already left office. So they, I think, are hoping to avoid discussion of the substance of the charges, which is that he incited the riot at the Capitol on January 6th and get away from Trump's antics and inflammatory rhetoric.
The thing is, Molly, that right after the riot, you had some lawmakers on the Republican side blaming President Trump, people like Mitch McConnell, who rarely, if ever, said anything bad about Donald Trump. Kevin McCarthy, the leader of House Republicans, who has so closely aligned himself with Trump, even blamed Trump. But now you have this vote in the Senate that Linda mentioned, where most Republicans wanted to throw out the trial from the get-go. And you also seem to have Republicans who split with President Trump now walking that back. Why is that, Molly?
We've really seen the tide turn on this issue. As you said, it really did seem in the immediate aftermath of the attack, particularly before the new president was inaugurated, that there was a real willingness among Republicans, even quite senior and Republicans who'd been friendly to Trump, to turn on him and to try to sort of cast him out of the Republican Party. He remains a problem for the Republican Party going forward because of the divisions within their ranks, because you do have a sizable faction of the party that would like to reset its image because he is and has been so unpopular with the broader public. But then another sizable faction, and indeed most of the Republican rank and file Republican base that remains quite committed and devoted to Trump. So I think the interesting questions are, as Linda mentioned, what we've heard from allies of the president is this procedural defense rather than trying to defend him on the substance, saying that on questions of process that the trial is itself illegitimate for technical reasons or for just sort of on a conceptual level that this isn't an issue we should be dealing with, we should be moving on, that if the new president wants to unite the country, he should not be focusing on these divisive questions of accountability for the past. The other thing I'm interested to hear going forward is When Trump does mount his official defense, he's retained a lawyer from South Carolina to speak for him in this matter and has a deadline coming up next week to officially answer the summons from Congress. Will he express any kind of contrition? We know he has this inability to express regret or apologize for pretty much anything. There is a real hunger among Republicans, even those who don't want to convict him, to see some sort of accountability, just to be able to say to the public, we didn't let this go unpunished since it was so serious and since lawmakers themselves were at risk.
But Molly, I just want to follow up with you. You've covered Trump these past 4 years. Do you really think he's going to apologize?
No. I don't make predictions, but that seems pretty in keeping with his personality. He's not somebody who expresses a lot of regret.
Linda, I want to go back to you. I think you both have been bringing up this point that the Democrats would like this trial to go as quick as possible, given that Republicans, they will not get, again, no predictions here, Republicans have done and said very unlikely that they'll get enough Republican support. So putting aside sort of the moral and ethical questions here about whether Trump is guilty, holding him accountable, from a purely political perspective, and we are talking about Washington, politics matters here, what do Democrats gain from the trial if Trump, at the end of the day, is not convicted?
What Democrats gain is, in some ways, is a little bit of a sense of closure in their dealings with Donald Trump. Trump is no longer president, but this is them addressing one of his final acts of his presidency, which was, in the view of many, completely outrageous. So while they know that it's probably a losing proposition that they can convict him and potentially ban him from running for office again, I think they feel that what he did was just so egregious that it had to be dealt with, even if they're trying to get this over with quickly. You know, the downside for them is that it cuts into Joe Biden's message of unity, bipartisanship. There was, as Molly said, this early bipartisan agreement that what Trump had done was wrong. You did have a lot of top Republicans coming out against the president's rally on January the 6th, but that has quickly evaporated. And Donald Trump himself is now sitting in Florida and has set up his, quote, office of the former president. So he's acknowledging he's former and not really the rightfully elected president, and has had senior aides making phone calls to senators just to make sure they're still on the team, are not going to vote to convict. And oh, by the way, if you go against us, you might see a primary in your future.
We're already seeing Republicans in the House who voted to impeach. Other Republicans are trying to punish them for that. Molly, did you want to jump in with something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add really quickly. I mean, the public opinion is on the Democrat side here. Convicting Trump is popular with a solid majority of the public. It's not popular with Republicans, but it is popular with the broader public, Democrats, independents, swing voters. There is a really broad sense in polls and in public opinion that Americans saw this as an egregious national tragedy and do want someone held accountable and do believe that President Trump bears some blame here. So I think there is a real opportunity for the Democrats here in the Republicans not wanting to hold Trump accountable, because they can then go to voters and say, our country was attacked, America was attacked, the American government was attacked, and our opponents here, the Republicans, simply did not want to do anything about it.
And that seems to be something that Chuck Schumer, who now leads the Senate because the Democrats have the majority, has been saying, that he wants to get Republicans on record. Even if they don't vote to convict, it can be used against them in upcoming elections. Let's pause here and we'll take a break and we'll continue the conversation on the other side.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, Political and Foreign Affairs Correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. Biden made unity a centerpiece in his inauguration speech, bringing the country back together, working with the other side. He's been in office about 10 days or so. It's not that long of a time. But in those 10 days, Linda, what steps, if any, has Biden taken to reach out to Republicans? And on the flip side, are Republicans interested in working with Biden?
Joe Biden, I don't know that he's done a whole lot of outreach yet. His main activity since taking office has been to sign a whole lot of executive orders which are things that he can just do with his signature, doesn't need congressional approval. A lot of it is the reversal of the Trump agenda, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, canceling the Keystone XL pipeline, canceling the so-called Muslim travel ban, reaffirming a program that was instituted under President Obama, providing deportation protection for young undocumented people in this country. One of the norms of the early days of a presidency, which is that the new president sits down and signs a whole lot of orders, either to undo the previous president from the other party or to just put in place things that he wants to really lay down that marker, things that don't need congressional approval. Of course, there's a lot that needs Congress to weigh in, and that upcoming very quickly is the COVID relief package. The pandemic is front and center on his agenda, and they are moving now to pass legislation in Congress, potentially actually as two bills, one that they are hoping to get with bipartisan support.
A lot to unpack in your answer, and we're going to touch on a lot of those points, but I want to stick with unity for a moment, Molly. Biden said he would be president for those who did not vote for him. 74 million Americans did not vote for him. It doesn't seem likely that Biden can win over people steeped in conspiracy theories, the ones who marched on the Capitol. But there are plenty of Republicans who did not think the insurrection was a good thing at all, and there are polls to back that up. But they're just not Democrats. They hold conservative ideals. They feel increasingly alienated by the mainstream discourse. So how does and can Biden win them over? And then in addition, what can be done about this growing conspiracy theory problem that's a really big internal problem for the Republicans?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different levels to this unity question. We heard in President Biden's opening address him trying to say what he meant by this idea of unity, that it, of course, is not going to mean unanimity. It, of course, is not going to mean that everybody suddenly agrees on the direction forward for the country or how the Congress should govern when it comes to issues, or that he gets 100% of the vote the next time he's on the ballot. He doesn't expect 74 million Americans to suddenly wake up and be Democrats. But he did, he said, want to end this quote-unquote uncivil war. He wanted to, unlike his predecessor, set a unifying tone in his rhetoric and to send a message that the changes he is making to the government are intended to help everybody, that where Trump often would do things and say point blank that this was something he was doing for his supporters and not for the rest of the country, even in some cases seeking to punish blue states and their governments and their residents in the policies that he enacted. This administration is trying to say to the public, we're doing this for everyone. We want to help everyone. The policies we're making are intended to help everyone. And those 74 million who didn't support him, that he still views them as Americans who should be part of his governing vision. Now, is that convincing to people? I doubt it, frankly. And what we are seeing from Republicans is very much a replay of 2009, where they correctly saw that the president's promise of bipartisanship and coming together in Washington was something they could veto, was something that they could say, well, if we don't go along with it, look, you're not accomplishing your goal. And so we've heard a lot of rhetoric from Republicans to that end. But on the policy question, on the governing question, there are talks going on between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to see if they can come up with some agreement. But there's also talks that are exclusively among Democrats about how they can pass the COVID relief and other policies on a party line vote. So I think it's really an open question which way this thing is going to go on Capitol Hill.
Right. And you have Republicans saying it's not all rhetoric. We want to see actual concrete steps taken by the administration, although rhetoric does matter. We've seen that in the past 4 years. And it's not all on Biden, of course, Linda. I mean, the Republican Party is having this fight internally. You have Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. A new report now says that she supported executing Democrats on her Facebook page before she was elected. That doesn't exactly scream unity. Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, the Republican senator, he's saying that Republicans who were spreading lies about election fraud shouldn't be complaining about the Democrats inflaming and dividing the country. So the Republicans have to figure this out among themselves as well.
Absolutely. No, the Republican Party is in a state of turmoil. They're out of power. from both the White House and in both chambers on Capitol Hill. You have fringe members. There's no other way to put it. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert. These are both freshman women members. You had Lauren Boebert, you know, she carries a gun, which is controversial to say the least. And then you have the few Republican members who are willing to speak out in a very public way, like Mitt Romney, trying to kind of hold on to that old style collegial establishment Republicanism. Even if there are policy disputes, you can still have a reasonable conversation. So the party is, you know, they're trying to keep it all together, but at the same time, it's really hard in this day of social media and 24/7 media in general to keep the people that are on the fringe from getting a lot of attention.
Right. They have a massive platform on social media. Anything they can say gets retweeted and liked, et cetera. Molly, I want to go back to Linda brought up this slate of executive orders that Biden has signed in his first days. It's funny, not haha funny, but funny in sort of a Washington way, because Obama was heavily criticized for relying on executive orders. Democrats then criticized Trump for doing the same thing. And now Biden is getting that same criticism. But sort of putting aside that criticism, is there an issue here with Congress conceding control and the executive sort of taking that control away from Congress?
Yeah, in broader terms, this is a decades-long trend, and it does come from both sides, right? You've had presidents increasingly seeking to act unilaterally, while Congress is increasingly gridlocked and incapable of doing anything or very much when it comes to policymaking. You know, you have the Congress saying, well, the president shouldn't be doing this. This is our job. And the president saying, well, why don't you do your job then? Why make me do it? Biden has set a record for the amount of executive orders and actions he's taken. Now just over a week on the job. Most of those executive orders, however, and actions are simply undoing or unwinding actions that Trump had taken unilaterally, because over the course of his presidency, he did on many occasions set annual records for the number of executive orders and actions that he took, which Democrats criticized as a sort of, you know, imperial presidency approach, that he simply wanted to do things unilaterally because he believed himself to be the sole authority. So, you know, if Congress wanted to take back these powers, it could. And there are some in Congress who would like to see that. And there is some legislation pending to that effect. I don't see it being a huge subject of conversation on Capitol Hill. But I think this is something that we have seen going on for years and years in terms of the balance of power between the executive and the legislative branches.
Right. And as you mentioned, it's not only that Congress is ceding control, but it also, these executive orders can be overturned with the next administration. They don't really have lasting power as legislation does. I want to go to some pieces of legislation that are pending right now, specifically the COVID relief package. Linda, I think you brought this up. It's a big bill. I think it's $1.9 trillion, if I'm not mistaken. What's in it? Any chance of it passing? What's the Biden team doing to try and get Republicans on board?
So it contains a lot related to COVID directly. It enhances the stimulus payments to Americans who make under a certain amount to kind of plus up the amount that was given in the final package of the Trump administration. That's huge. You've got money in there to ramp up production of vaccine, to enhance the distribution, to increase the number of vaccinators. And then it also contains a piece that's rather controversial, which is to establish a $15 an hour minimum wage across the country. I tend to think that was thrown in there to make a statement, and then they'll give that away when all is said and done. But that is a long-held policy goal of Democratic progressives, the left wing of the Democratic Party. And this is something that the Biden administration is very keen to do. The Democrats have their own internal divisions and wings. Just as the Republicans are trying to keep it all together, so are the Democrats. And Biden, who's the classic Democratic centrist, he knows that he's with such slim majorities in both houses of Congress, he really needs to keep all of his people on board with him, including the most liberal.
Yeah, intra-party fighting is not unique to one side. While the White House and legislatures and lawmakers sort of hash this out, this COVID relief bill, the Biden administration has also put out their broader COVID plan, the cornerstones of which are faster testing, health equality, and boosting vaccinations. It's ambitious, although some health experts say on the vaccine front, it's not ambitious enough. Biden had been promising 100 million vaccines in his first 100 days. Experts say that number has to be much larger. Biden seems to be signaling now he wants to move past that goal. In general, Molly, what challenges does Biden face rolling out his COVID plan?
pretty much all of them. You know, the Trump administration rather deservedly did not have a very good reputation in this regard. The president was notoriously disengaged with the management of the pandemic. So we have seen the new administration really scrambling to reorient the course of things. They were accused when they first came in of sort of trying to be a little too cute by half with the expectation setting. We were already at a level above a million vaccinations a day by the time Joe Biden took the oath of office. So to say that he was going to get to that level was not really setting himself anything to strive for. And we have now seen the administration increase that. But the vaccination rollout has been slow. It has been difficult. It has been inconsistent across states. There has been a lot of waste and difficulty in the process. And we see the new administration talking a big game about really sort of making this a wartime effort type of surge using FEMA and so forth. It has yet to really materialize. And I think that's going to be, the proof is going to be in the pudding of whether they can really show that they have put some urgency into this using, you know, the Defense Production Act, using disaster funds to purchase more vaccines. I think this is something we're going to see in the coming weeks and months. Are they able to really turn this around and show the American people that they're serious about making this process really work?
And to that point, politicians can spin a lot of things. And we saw this trip up Trump as well. He promised at a certain point, any American who wants to get a test can get it. But then a lot of Americans who went out and tried to get a test saw that it wasn't so easy. And the same thing is, I'm assuming, is going to happen with Biden. He's promising that by spring, any American that wants a vaccine should be able to get it. But if by spring, Americans still are having a hard time getting vaccines, mm-hmm. the blame is going to be with Biden, no matter what Trump did going in. I mean, the buck will stop with Biden on this, right, Linda?
Absolutely. I think the whole ballgame for President Biden, if he is not perceived as having made serious progress, really turning around the American response to COVID, I think his presidency is effectively over. This is such a massive crisis, and they know this. In some ways, it's been extraordinary how, you know, we seem to see the waving of a wand. The Trump team left, the Biden team came in. We're now getting regular briefings. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease expert, can now speak freely. He's not feeling undermined and undercut by the administration. The messaging is extremely important. The public has to feel that the government at all levels is doing everything they can to get people vaccinated and to stop this.
The last question I have on this, Molly, is the challenge of getting schools open. The Biden team has said reopening schools is a priority, but they're getting a lot of pushback from school unions, from teacher unions, I should say. Teacher unions in big cities want to keep schools shut indefinitely, which goes against what the CDC is saying. A new CDC report out that you can reopen schools if you put in the right measures. It is possible to do this. You're having reports now. The New York Times just had this heartbreaking article about a spike in teen suicides. I think it was in Las Vegas. Kids can't go to school. Suicides are going up. Teachers unions have a lot of power, though, in the Democratic Party, especially on a local level. So how does Biden balance pleasing those unions? But also, there are a lot of parents who are really upset who will have a lot of power when it comes to the next election.
That's right. You know, I think that question of where the public is on this issue and where public pressure has been applied is really important, because in a lot of these districts, and the parents are the ones driving a lot of this. The policymakers who've been accused of sort of caving to the unions, they in a lot of cases have public pressure on their side. And so I think the most important thing here is going to be rebuilding the trust with the public to say, we're not politicizing this process. We are being responsive to the science, and the science says we can do this, because you have a lot of parents who just don't believe that. You have a lot of parents that when the teachers and their unions say, we don't think this is safe, they believe that, even if it's not necessarily true, because there has been so little trust in a lot of these communities, particularly those big cities that you're talking about, for the messages that were coming out of the Trump administration. So while it is true that the unions have been a big player in this, they see themselves as, you know, protecting the health and safety of their members. For example, Washington, D.C. right now, trying to open schools in person, there's a real question about whether any kids are going to show up in those schools. schools or whether parents are going to continue to choose to keep their kids home because they simply don't trust what they're hearing from the government about where the science is and whether it's safe.
It just goes to show what a challenge the Biden administration is facing, getting people to even trust the basic science that's coming out. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Shana Stulen. This program is produced by Voice of America. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this edition of PC USA. As the United States marked the birthday of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on January 18th of this year as a national holiday, the United States continues to reel from a deeply divided political and social landscape. In an outdoor ceremony in Atlanta, Georgia, on the national holiday of her father, the Reverend Bernice King, daughter of Martin Luther King Jr., spoke on the present state of the nation. She said, quote, "This King holiday has not only come at a time of great peril and physical violence, it has come during a time of violence in our speech, what we say and how we say it," unquote. King's most famous speech, known as I Have a Dream, was delivered in front of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, in front of some 250,000 people who had marched in a massive peaceful protest known as the March on Washington. This famous protest helped to create a new national understanding of the racial and economic injustice that existed in the United States. The speech was lauded in the days after the event and was widely considered the high point of the march by contemporary observers. James Reston, for example, a writer for the New York Times, said that, quote, "Dr. King touched all the themes of the day, only better than anyone else. He was full of the symbolism of Lincoln and Gandhi and the cadences of the Bible," unquote. On the evening of April 4, 1968, while standing on the balcony of his motel room in Memphis, Tennessee, where he was to lead a protest march in sympathy with striking garbage workers of that city, King was assassinated. Had he lived, he would have turned 92 on January 15th of this year. Today, as the U.S. begins a new year with a newly installed president and vice president, the world sees a country still politically and socially divided. The same divisions hold true around the globe. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace observed that, quote, "The coronavirus pandemic did not deter protesters around the world, despite restrictions on protest rights and the danger of gathering in groups," unquote. Between May 25th and November 18th, 2020, protests occurred in more than 4,446 cities worldwide, including in all states, territories, and Washington, D.C., and internationally in more than 60 countries. While most of the protests were peaceful, minor looting, broken windows, and arson were common. Although most of the global protests were linked to the racial injustice issues raised in the U.S., they also provided an opportunity for communities to raise their own issues. Many of the protests in the U.S. have ended with police shooting tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber or wooden bullets at protesters, including many who were protesting peacefully. There have been a number of protest-related shootings both against police and against protesters. Recently, on January 6th, as Congress was formally counting the electoral votes from the November 3rd, 2020 election, supporters of then-President Trump gathered for the Save America rally, where attendees heard speeches from Trump and Rudy Giuliani. Before the speeches were over, a mob of protesters marched on Congress and stormed the Capitol. Five people died as a result of the violence. Scenes of the violence were played repeatedly around the world, and the violence was widely condemned by political leaders and organizations in the United States and internationally. A week after the mob attack on the Capitol, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Donald Trump for what was termed incitement of insurrection, making him the only U.S. president to have been impeached twice. Well, joining me to discuss this event, the civil rights protest of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the protest of 2020 is Jesse Holland, journalist, historian, professor of media and public relations at George Washington University, and author. Jesse, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jesse, looking back on the speeches and protest marches of Dr. King, why do they still resonate today, and especially the speech known as I Have a Dream?
Well, simply because at that time, Dr. King, along with a coalition of other civil rights leaders, both Black and white, were all of the same accord that the country's power structure, its white power structure, had to change. They had to make changes for us to continue as a country. And it wasn't a political argument, it was a moral argument. And so when they went out on the mall, thousands and thousands of people, they were all of the same accord about one thing, and that's how this country had to change, that we needed to actually be moving toward that more perfect union that the founding fathers talked about. And it's hard to argue against what they were saying then, even though during that day, they were making no friends amongst the power structure and amongst those who were comfortable in the way the country was. But as we've looked at their arguments, as the years have gone by, no one can say that they were arguing for something that shouldn't have happened. That's why we still talk about it. That's why we still hear people quoting that speech even to this day.
Now, in contrast, when we look at what recently happened at the U.S. Capitol, while there have been other attacks and bombings of the Capitol in the 19th and 20th centuries, this 2021 attack was the first time that the Capitol had been breached or occupied since the 1814 burning of Washington by the British Army during the War of 1812. While this event has been termed a violent attack, insurrection, terrorism, riot, just to list a few terms of how people have been describing it, what would you call it, and how do you think it will go down in history?
Well, it was definitely a violent insurrection. You had American citizens, mostly, hopefully all American citizens, but mostly American citizens, attempting to stop the counting of the Electoral College that would have made President Joe Biden president. I don't know what else you can call this except insurrection and sedition. Now, this crowd began at a rally near the White House with then-President Donald Trump, and they marched up to Capitol Hill. So we're not going to say that every single person in that crowd intended to be an insurrectionist or a seditionist. But when they broke into the U.S. Capitol, when they stormed into the Senate and House chambers, when you had people in the crowd with zip ties, there's nothing else you can call it except what it was, and that was an attempt at overthrowing the duly elected government of the United States. Out of all of the civil rights marches, out of all of the protest marches that we've seen over this past year, or frankly, in hundreds of years, none of the protest marchers have said that the government should be overthrown and took violent action toward that. That's what made this so different and so horrifying, that American citizens would actually take violent action toward overthrowing the government on one of the most important days in our constitutional transfers of power.
And historically, how will this go down in history? What are the ramifications of that?
Well, historically, this January 6, 2021, is something that will actually go in the history books. It'll go alongside of the Whiskey Rebellion. It'll go alongside of the Bonus Army camps in Washington as a time in which American citizens took up arms against the American government. It'll actually go down in history similar to the Civil War, because it's been years since we've seen American citizens take up arms against the American government. Now, arms don't have to be guns. Arms can be sticks. Arms can be posters. Arms can be your fists. American citizens at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th took up arms against the American government in an attempt to seat someone who had lost in the presidential election. Now, once again, let me be clear. There were plenty of people in that crowd who were just following their constitutional rights of peaceable assembly. So there's nothing wrong with protesting. But those in that crowd who took the violent and illegal action of breaking into the U.S. Capitol, and even worse, those in that crowd who had the intention of harming people like Vice President Michael Pence, like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, like any member, sitting member of Congress, those who had intention of harming, kidnapping, or even worse, killing those members of our U.S. government, they will likely face the full weight of the law when they arrest them and bring them back to D.C. to face trial for what they did.
Now, I just want to go back in time looking at the protests and uprisings of the 1960s, which were primarily led by African Americans, differing from the 2021 attack on the Capitol, and differing from their precursors in 1919 and 1943, where race riots were instigated by white mobs in Chicago, Tulsa, Detroit, and Los Angeles. So why were the protests in the 1960s, why were they different?
Because those were not political protests. Those protests were not an argument to seat a member of the Democratic Party or to seat a member of the Republican Party or the Green Party or the Independent Party or the Whig Party or whoever else, whatever other political flavor might be out there. Those were protests over human rights. We tend to call them civil rights, but those protests were over human rights, the right to not be killed by the police, the right not to be harmed by other members of the society you live in. So while the King and civil rights protests were protests to make people's lives better, the protests we saw at the U.S. Capitol didn't have to do with anyone's day-to-day life. All it had to do with is seating a particular member of a political party who had lost a presidential election. Those people who broke into the Capitol, they weren't breaking into the Capitol to demand civil rights. They weren't breaking in the Capitol to demand human rights. They were breaking in the Capitol to demand that their favorite political candidate be seated again as president illegally. And the rightfully elected candidate be refused his office that the American people voted for him to get. So there is no comparison in their intent. There's really very little in comparison in their actions, because very few of the civil rights marches ended up in violence toward the U.S. government. There may have been some looting. There may have been some rioting from people who were adjacent to the marches. But the goal of the march was not to overthrow the U.S. government. And that's what will make the rioters of January 6, 2021 stand out in history forever.
Also, more than ever before, today's demonstrations and protests are markedly interracial. You have Americans of all races, for instance, this past year, covered by masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19, well, they appeared in city centers, blockaded across bridges and highways, and they gathered in front of the White House. What would you say is the motivating factor for this uniting of races in America?
Because as we've moved forward in history in America, there have been a lot of people from all races, all religions, all colors, all creeds to join movements for all different types of things. The crowd that broke into the U.S. Capitol was not a all-white crowd. There were people of other races in that crowd. Now, the crowd was mostly white, but there were people of other races, creeds, and colors in that crowd. Just like back, if you look back into the civil rights movements of the 1960s, while we talk mostly about the African-American leaders of the civil rights movements, there were rabbis, there were Southern Baptist ministers. The civil rights movement was also a multi-race, multi-creed movement. However, the leaders of the civil rights movement were mostly African-American, just like the leaders of the insurrectionist riot at the U.S. Capitol were mostly white Americans. So you have to look very hard to find a legitimate movement in the United States that is not multiracial, multigender, multi-creed, and frankly, multi-sexuality. As we've moved forward in America, all groups have realized that they can take part in almost all movements. And so you can usually find many people of many colors and many creeds in all of the movements you see in the United States now.
Okay, and with that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jesse Holland, journalist, historian, and professor of media and public relations at George Washington University and author. I'm Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener in Nigeria, Gloria Olabadan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Now back to our discussion on protest from the March on Washington to the 1968 riots to the recent attack on the Capitol with our guest, Jesse Holland. Well, Jesse, the geography of violence and looting looks different in 2020 as well, not only with the interracial aspect of it. The clashes of the past happened mostly in Black neighborhoods. Well, today they have often started and spread to wealthy downtown areas and suburban shopping malls. Looters have gone after local shops and global chains in wealthy neighborhoods such as Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, Soho in New York, and Buckhead in Atlanta. What is the significance of the geography of protests that turn violent?
When we saw violent protests in the past, when you talk about the protests that happened around the Rodney King incident in Los Angeles and Watts, normally those protests began in the neighborhoods of the people who are being oppressed. So those protests would begin in those African-American neighborhoods. Or you would see, for example, during the Red Summer riots, you would see white Americans come to the African-American neighborhoods and begin violence, as we saw happen in 1919 during the Red Summer riots in Washington, D.C., Elaine, Arkansas, and other places. The difference we saw on January 6th was that these were people mostly who were not from Washington, D.C., who came here for the rally that then President Trump called for. And then they marched straight through the center of the American government down the National Mall into the Capitol. So the violence we saw was not around the neighborhoods that are being oppressed. It was political violence that struck straight at the heart of the US government. And when we saw a lot of this type of political violence this year, it seemed to revolve around government buildings. We had the takeover of the Michigan State House late last year as well. These are people who are protesting their government, protesting their own government, and they're taking the violence to the seats of those that governmental power. That's why we saw during the inauguration a huge push by the U.S. government to not only secure the U.S. Capitol and the White House, but state houses around the nation. Because that seems to be the target that these political protesters are aiming at right now. And so that's where we saw the protection. We didn't see as much protection in the downtown cores of cities, but where we saw the protection was around federal buildings and state governmental buildings, because that seems to be the target right now.
Well, in 2013, the Black Lives Matter movement was started by Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi in response to the acquittal of a Florida man who fatally shot an unarmed 17-year-old Black student, Trayvon Martin, who was visiting relatives in a gated community. The coalition uses protests, social media, and publicity to shine a bright light on police violence against African Americans. Jesse, what do you think Dr. King would say about Black Lives Matter?
I would think that Dr. King would be completely for the nonviolent protesting that happened during the Black Lives Matter movement. He would be completely against the adjacent rioting that happened by people who tried to take advantage of those marches. But I think Dr. King would have been completely for American citizens using their constitutional right of assembly to call on governments to make their lives better and to act morally. I don't think he would have had a single problem with it. And I think my contention is also backed up by civil rights leaders who remember Dr. King and worked with him, like Jesse Jackson.
And how would you compare the protest of Dr. King with Black Lives Matter?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to compare the two because the differing situations in which those protests happen. Keep in mind, back during the civil rights movement, you had governmental forces, including state and local law enforcement departments, who had no compunction of using violence against those protesters. No one can say that Bull Connor in Alabama and the state highway patrol in several southern states were complicit in violence against civil rights protesters. Today, when you have protests like Black Lives Matter, they are protesting out in the streets where they are not as concerned about the violence from police departments. There is still some concern about how you're going to be treated. But the civil rights movement, they had to worry about whether their lives would be taken. So it's two completely different times, but the goals are still the same. The goals are, you see a wrong and you're trying to bring attention to it. So I think the protests for Black Lives Matter and the protests for civil rights, while they had different goals, I think they are more alike than they are separate, even though many, many years separate the two.
Okay, so now the solidarity of today's protesters transcends the bloody racial divides of the past and may be a springboard for more sweeping reforms. For instance, George Floyd's death has sparked a global movement with the statues of slave owners being torn down from Bristol, England to Richmond, Virginia. And of course, you and I spoke about this months ago. Mm-hmm. Anti-police protesters taking the knee from Seattle to Rio de Janeiro and Rome. And the U.S. public officials debating whether to defund or rebuild their police forces from the ground up. So what would you say is the future of protest, and what do you think future protesters will look like?
One of the things that we are actually concerned about here in Washington, D.C., is how the police forces of the nation's capital are going to react to the next set of protesters that show up here, whether violent or nonviolent. We understand that after what happened on January 6th, many police departments in D.C. felt embarrassed that they were not prepared, and they literally could have lost members of the U.S. government to a violent insurrectionist crowd. So some of us here in D.C. are worried about an overreaction to what happened from police departments, where they're going to attempt to use the excuse of not being prepared on January 6th to overreact to the next set of peaceful protesters that come to Washington, D.C. So I think what we're still trying to find a new equilibrium between policing and protest here in Washington, and I would suspect around the country, because once again, the police departments were completely unprepared for what they saw on January 6th. And usually when someone is unprepared like that and embarrassed on national television for not doing their job, they get embarrassed and then they overreact to the next situation. So hopefully when we see more protests in the future, and we will see more protests in the future because it's a constitutionally right to peaceably assemble in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Hopefully when we see that, when we see those protests, we also won't see an overreaction from a police department anywhere in the nation who feels embarrassed by their lack of preparation on January 6th?
Well, many observers that I even spoke to about the attack on January 6th, the question was, how could they have not been prepared?
Well, I mean, honestly, there are many people who will tell you that it was an aspect of white privilege in the United States, that even on a day in which we had a constitutional action going on, the counting of the Electoral College votes, that police departments in Washington, D.C. did not feel that a majority white crowd that was in Washington, D.C. would resort to a violent insurrection. Now, there are people who compare what the police reactions were to the Black Lives Matter movement, where we saw police in body armor, militarized equipment, and weapons brought out to monitor what was mostly a peaceful march. Where was that response for the march that happened in Washington on January 6th, which actually did turn violent and turned into one of the few attacks on the U.S. Capitol in American history? So there are those who will tell you that the reaction of police not being ready, despite having a worked up crowd in Washington, D.C., on the day that they were counting the Electoral College votes, would be a symptom of white privilege in the United States. So what, once again, this is something that we'll be watching when a non-majority white crowd decides to protest in Washington again. Will they have a ridiculous overcompensation, which once again, people will then point out that, hey, where was this when the crowd tried to take over the Capitol?
Looking back over the events that occurred in 2020 and the fact that there still is a social and political divide that does exist, what do you think Dr. King would say about it, looking at the political and social landscape of today here in the U.S.?
Well, hopefully Dr. King would have words of inspiration for us that would help us all figure out how we're going to move forward in this country, which is deeply, deeply divided. Hopefully, he would have words of encouragement, but I think also he would tell Americans that they should never give up their right to protest. They should never give up their right to peaceably assemble, because the only way our government gets better is not by sitting and waiting. It's by people going out there and working to make it better. The attack on the U.S. Capitol did end up being positive in one way, because even though there were people inside the U.S. Capitol who were sympathetic to the cause of the rioters, the U.S. government continued along its peaceful transition of power. Even though it had to be delayed because of the rioters, it showed the strength of the U.S. government that same day, later on that evening, Congress came back and took care of its constitutional duty of counting the Electoral College votes and making it official that Joe Biden would become president. Now, it would have been a bigger shame if rioters forced a delay in the peaceful transfer of power between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. But one of the things that we can say about our government is that even faced with violent insurrectionists, they were still willing to go along and do the hard work of government, transferring from one administration to the other. Even faced with one of its greatest challenges in hundreds of years, our lawmakers, our U.S. Congress, stuck to the Constitution and moved forward with what they knew they were supposed to do. That says something about the resiliency of our government and the consistency of the belief in the Constitution, even faced with a violent crowd.
And you think that is how the international community has observed it as well?
Well, probably not, because this was something that was not supposed to happen in the United States. This was not something that not only Americans couldn't believe, but people watching the American government around the world couldn't believe. No one expected this to happen. And it is a bit of a failure that the riot actually happened. But you also have to look at it from the point of, even in the face of violence, the American government stood strong and a peaceful transfer of power happened. This says that even though there may be bumps along the road, democracy can still work and can stand strong. And the American government has moved forward to where we are today with a new president and a peaceful transfer of power.
And we're going to have to end the show on that note. I want to thank my guest, Jesse Holland, journalist, historian, author, and professor of media and public relations at George Washington University. Thank you so much, Jesse, for joining me and for a most interesting and insightful program. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Pikesville, Maryland. I'm Kim Lewis. Be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News with your remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, and here are some of the stories.